is Michael Schultz, director of Car Wash Cooley High, Grease Lightning, Which Way Is Up, Sergeant Pepper Is On and On, The Last Dragon, and you are listening to Film Wax Radio.
Hey everybody, Adam Shartoff here, host of Film Wax Radio, episode number 447 of the podcast. How the heck are you? I am doing okay. Update on the Kickstarter, because I know you're interested. If you're listening to this, have you kicked in a dollar? Have you done that? Have you? Do you know Hal Hartley? He's been on the show. He contributed. I just want to say that. I'm not going to say how much, although it's out in the world. Neela Butte, he contributed. So many other filmmakers are being generous. And anyway, at the posting of this, you have about 5 or 6 more days. We're about almost two-thirds of the way to the goal. Now, I understand a lot of the activity happens at the very last days, hours. So I'm not going to freak out yet. I've decided not to freak out. But I do desperately, having said that, I do really, really need people to, excuse me, take a moment. And it could be between now and Wednesday. The campaign ends Wednesday, December 7th. I know you're probably just getting out there to the holiday parties just around then. So I'm hoping I'm beating most of you to the punch with that. But just, you know, any amount, of course, I'm sure you've heard this before, but of course, any amount, small or not small, is appreciated. And also just sharing the campaign. And you can contact me, and I'll even give you the words, the verbiage, the language to tweet or Facebook out there or Instagram, however you want to do it. I'm happy to do it. Just get in touch with me through either filmwaxradio.com. There's a link on the homepage. And then, which, by the way, will look very different in a couple of months if I make my goal. I will have enough money to finally redesign. That's one of the many things I'm trying to accomplish with this campaign. So, but you can reach me that way, or you can go through Facebook at Feel Free. I'm very easy to reach. You could tweet me direct, DM me, whatever you want to do. And say, you know, hey, could you just give me some language or something so I could retweet it for you? But go to the campaign. You go to Kickstarter and then just search Film Wax. It comes right up. And then, you know, check out the video, check out the rewards. I got to put in some more rewards in the last days here, actually, because we're running out of some stuff. But there's stuff for everybody. Anyway, so if you know anybody who loves films or loves independent films or what have you, documentaries, who you know that this would be great, go in and do that. And while you're there, subscribe on iTunes to Film Wax Radio. It gives you an opportunity right there to write up a review, give it a star rating, and all these things really help. So thank you for that. All right, again, Film Wax Radio, Kickstarter campaign, 5 or 6 more days, and then it's all done. Maybe in a few months from now, you're going to find a somewhat upgraded show. You'll still have the heart of it will be, the soul of it will be the same, essentially speaking, but how it's, you know, delivered, and it'll be on more platforms, and more people will have access to it, and we'll have even a broader array of guests. But I'm sticking to the approach, which is that if you're just a good storyteller or you have something significant you want to express through the medium of film, I'm there. So if it's your first film or your 20th film, there's a place for you on Film Wax Radio. That will not change. Okay, so here we go. Episode 447. Speaking of 20 films, you know, one of the nice things about doing this show now, there's so many people have been on it. I can pretty much reach out to anybody, and I mean, they may not respond, but they're not going to not take it like this is a legitimate thing now, right? So, Eric Schaefer is just, he came on the scene 24 years ago with My Life's in Turnaround. And it was picked up by John Pearson, became the, it's kind of well known. If you read John Pearson's book, Spike, Mike, Slackers, and Dykes, you'll know the whole story. But he was on the fence a little bit with My Life's in Turnaround, not because of the quality, just because there have been, you know, he wasn't like a sure thing. He'd been, basically helped along a number of seminal independent films through Sundance and Cannes and getting them major distribution. And because of how low the cost of making the film was, that these people had a real opportunity all of a sudden because they sold their film for a tremendous amount compared to what they spent. And actually, Eric Schaefer was right there. He's one of the guys. You know, a little overshadowed perhaps by Jim Jarmusch and Spike and a couple of the other folks that were emerging at the time. But Eric Schaefer is in there, right in there, actually. And My Life's in Turnaround, which came out in, I think, 93 or so, 93, 94, is a lot of fun to watch. He, at the time, had an artistic partner whose name is Donald Lardner Ward. And so it's a worth seeing. It's you should see it if you haven't seen it yet. Do search out My Life's in Turnaround. But since then, Eric has made a number of films, including If Lucy Fell, Fall, Wiry Spindell, Never Again, Mind the Gap, They're Out of the Business, which I believe is a sequel to My Life's in Turnaround, and then After Fall, Winter, and most recently, Boy Meets Girl. Now, he also has been keeping extremely busy because he's done a couple of series, including Gravity, and he did a nonfiction series called I Can't Believe I'm Still Single, which is extremely entertaining if you can find it. He also has a web series about being a personal life coach called Eric Schaefer Life Coach, which I recommend. You can find it on YouTube, the whole thing. He's done tons of them. It's you know, he just does some of this a little under the wire, but then he comes back with a feature film or a TV show or something, and he's never too far. So, you know, I've always thought of this guy as just what drives him to do the kind of stuff he does in the way he does it with the kind of obsessions that keep coming back. So I really wanted to ask him about it. And he lives in New York City, and so it was actually kind of easy to find him. I reached out to him a couple of years ago when his most recent film came out because I wanted to talk to him about his career, and that didn't happen. But subsequently, you know, it occurred to me, whatever happened to that? Let me email him now that I have his email. And he got right back to me, and we set up a time. We decided it was a beautiful, I guess it was a late summer day, and we just decided to meet in the park and sit on a park bench. You know, right out of like an Eric Schaefer movie or like a, maybe years ago, a Woody Allen movie, you know, and we did it from just New York City, looking out on the river. We had a great time, and we hit it off. I like to think so. Anyway, so what you're hearing in a minute now is a long conversation with this true independently spirited filmmaker named Eric Schaefer. And honestly, I think the guy is terrific. And, he's a great, great podcast guest, and you'll see why right about now. This is Eric Schaefer, filmmaker and actor, right here on FilmWax Radio. Eating Animals?
Yeah, no, but all those books, all those Diet for New America, John, you know, all those things.
They'll turn you off. I mean, I was living with a vegan until recently. We split, but she was vegetarian the first time, you know, and then she became vegan. And then it was just it's such an enormous commitment. But you're, at least in New York City, it's...
Yeah, super easy. I loved it. I loved it when I did it for 3 years, I mean, for many, many reasons. And then I just, either I wasn't eating enough certain things, but I started to feel anemic. And ironically, are we on?
Sorry, yeah.
Ironically,
we're just running now.
Right before I did Starved, I started eating meat again because I was just, my brain wasn't functioning with
that.
An acuity that I needed.
Right.
And I felt anemic.
How did that feel after 3 years?
Well, you know, it's interesting because while I certainly didn't like, that's a small way to put it, I hated the way animals are treated and stuff. I didn't necessarily do it for ethical reasons when I started.
I understand.
I did it for health reasons. But then when I stopped, I didn't realize that I had sort of, the ethics had sort of caught up to me and surpassed almost the health, and I felt very sad being part of the meat-eating community again.
Yeah.
But I sort of felt like if my body's not functioning well, I can't help anyone, animals, humans, anybody. Like if I can't think or I'm going to drop dead. And so I started eating meat again, sort of against my will, but still being 80% vegan. Uh-huh. I would just sort of have animal products. So again, it's just not this notion of all or nothing, right? It's it doesn't have to be. If you put everything I eat on a table, it's 80% vegan. and 20% not.
Right. I mean, there's also the side to the whole situation where you can be vegetarian but be eating donuts and pizza. Sure,
you can be completely, abjectly unhealthy.
It's hard to do that if you're vegan because there's not that much available and you can't eat spontaneously.
Well, you can eat potatoes and bread all day long.
Well,
and still
suppose that's
huge.
True.
I mean,
right.
I started being vegan because sugar, right? Well, yeah, you can.
Yeah.
Well, no. Well, white sugar is processed with animal bones, so vegans, I don't need
with
white
animal
sugar.
Animal bones?
Yeah, it's processed with animal bones.
That I hadn't heard of.
Yeah. So a lot of vegans won't eat white sugar just for that reason, where you get sugar that's not processed with animal bones. But no, you could be certainly very unhealthy. There's plenty to eat as a vegan and
true.
Still be.
Right.
I mean, you could have tempura, you can have fry, you could have.
Yeah.
Most, it's so oxymoronic. I think most vegans tend not to be radically unhealthy.
Yeah.
Or they go the other way and they get sort of super unhealthy because they don't eat enough. But anyway, I'm 8 days back being vegan because I watched this HBO documentary.
Which one?
I think it was called What the Health.
I heard about it, but I haven't seen it.
Netflix, not HBO. Either
okay.
Netflix or... I forget.
Doesn't
maybe
matter.
HBO. One
not,
of the
again, I'll have my fact checker on it.
Yeah. And I liked it. It was about a guy who... I'd seen a lot of stuff before. It was kind of a supersize me feeling thing, but he just went and interviewed a lot of people and found that all these people wouldn't discuss almost his policy diet. Like the American Diabetes Association, the American Heart Association. Mm-hmm. When he asked them about diet as a issue, as a preventative for these diseases, that these, no one, almost his policy said, well, we can't talk about diet.
Why do you suppose that was?
Well, because
what was
that would rationale? That would eradicate the disease.
Mm-hmm.
And all these people, obviously big pharma, big medical, has an investment in keeping you sick.
Yes.
Or treating the sickness, not the preventative.
Right.
So anyway, very interesting. And we saw that and then just, all you have to hear is the word pus with milk and yogurt and you're not going to eat it.
No, it's very true. Well, again, having read Jonathan's book, which is called Eating Animals, it's a big seller, big bestseller. And then living with a vegan, and so I approached my son, and I said, he was already kind of skeptical about me because he saw me eating a lot less meat and more vegan-like because I just would eat whatever we were eating.
When you were
my
dating
girl,
the vegan.
When I was living with, and I was happy to do it, when I was out about on my own, I was a little less cautious, admittedly, but, and then, I said, Jake, we really should, I'm not going to go vegetarian. I said, I'm not going to ask you to do that. He's 13, So I said, but let's be more thoughtful about the meat we do get.
Totally.
Like, there's all this factory farming. We should try to not ever get stuff that has been factory farmed because it's just awful. And he wasn't even quite ready to listen to that, even though he's a very sensitive kid.
Yeah.
And he does know, he did a document. He, at school, made a documentary with his friends about fast food.
Uh-huh.
The industry, and he stopped eating on his own. Like, he just would never wants to go to get
well,
fast
yeah,
food
well, that, that's like supersized me is the Bible of that. You know what
right.
I mean? But and what you said, yeah, factory farming. Listen, I don't advocate whatever. Bodies are so unique, but at least have a sensitivity, as you say, almost an American Indian kind of point of view about thanking the life.
Right.
Just being aware.
Be at one with it.
Yeah, well, say thank you for your sacrifice, Mr. Animal. You know what I mean?
Yeah, like, right, exactly.
If I'm going to eat meat, I would at least do that, have thoughtfulness about it.
Uh-huh.
Not that it's just in this package.
Sure.
But the factory farming thing, forget that. That's just, you have to just watch one movie about that.
Yeah.
And it's hard to, in good conscience.
Well,
for
do
me,
yourself
at least.
A favor. I mean, if I had known, I would have brought my copy, but just pick up that book because honestly, after all the already the due diligence that you've done and the thought that you've given to it, this is not going to come as any shock to you, but it will reinforce your decision in all the best ways. So I would recommend actually picking it up, and it's a good read, and he's a very good writer, So
yeah,
I don't know if not Franzen. I misspoke. John, what the? This is one of those off days, where names are just not going to come to me.
I hate when that happens. It's on the tip
man.
Of your tongue.
Safran Foer.
Ah,
Jonathan Safran Foer.
Okay. Thanks.
Do you know him?
No.
He's the one that wrote Everything is Illuminated, and he wrote...
I don't read. I've read three books
No, but
life.
They made him into...
Jaws,
sure
Ruby Fruit
you.
Jungle, and even Cowgirls Get the Blues. Those are the three
well,
books
Well, those
I've
are the
read
big three. So it's a good... I don't believe that.
It's absolutely the truth. I took a class in Orwell in 11th grade. I read Keep the Aspidistras Flying,
oh, I love
Animal
that
Farm,
one.
And
I love
1984.
That right.
So those three and
really?
The other three. Those are the six books I've read my whole life. I sort of feel like since I haven't started, how start now? There's so many. Like, I could never... It's a really good attitude, but I love writing. People say, how can you write and not read it? Because they're two completely different things. I love writing. It doesn't mean I like to read.
I suppose. Yeah, no, it's true. They are different things. But I guess a passion for words, you think, maybe?
Yeah,
but
writing them, hearing them.
Well, that goes all my questions, because it's just going to ask you about all your favorite books. So that,
I will say it's I'm a guilty. Around. I'm also a little dyslexic, and I wasn't a good reader. So that didn't make me excited.
Right.
But I get the sort of opposite experience that most people get from a book.
Sounds like that.
I feel when I'm in a book, I'm missing the world. And most people feel like that opens up this incredible world to them reading a book. Yeah. But I'm a watcher. I'm an Aquarian. I feel like if I'm buried in a book, I'm missing all this incredible world around me that I can visually see.
I suppose that's an argument.
Yeah, I have no good argument. It's just a personal thing.
Right.
But I will say the few times that I've been charged with reading a book to maybe adapt it for a movie, as a job or something, I love it.
Well,
so
everything.
I'm totally full of shit. Like if when I do
you
do
read
it,
other books then.
No, I haven't.
Okay.
But when I do it, the few times, one or two times, I love it.
So Jaws. Let's talk about Jaws. Jaws. They made into a really great movie.
Yeah, I saw that.
Even Cowgirls Get Through. Sorry, Gus Van Sant, but it was not a good movie at all.
I don't think I saw his version.
Don't go see it now.
And then Ruby for Jungle. So
Was that your lesbian face?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
This was all 1978. This was like when I was sophomore in high school.
Let me ask you then, during that period when you were reading those books, what was that like for you if you were all of a sudden a reader?
On acid, right? I was taking a lot of acid and doing a lot of drugs.
Now it's my turn not to be sure if you're joking or not.
No, that's for true. Yeah, I've been clean and dry for 34 years.
Uh-huh.
But back then I was active radical alcoholic drug addict.
Really?
Oh yeah. Since from 13 to 21.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was 10th grade. So it was all day drugs and alcohol and reading these couple books and being a hippie. And
okay.
I don't know why I got into it. And then the Orwell class was as a junior in high school and read those.
That's when I read them too. I think junior high school.
Yeah,
so you. Go ahead.
So I don't know that I felt like I was now, quote unquote, a reader because I had read two books.
An addict
in class.
Slash reader. Huh.
Oh, you know what? One other one I read.
Why did they try it?
The Eden Express I read by Mark Vonnegut, Vonnegut's junior. The Eden Express.
Kurt Vonnegut's son?
Yes.
Oh.
And it was called
Mark
The Eden
Vonnegut.
Express, about him going crazy or having a nervous breakdown. It was really good.
Oh. Interesting.
Listen, I read a little New Age. I've read, Eckhart Tolle,
I take your
the
word.
Power of Now. I like.
Are
spiritual
you reading
literature.
Real books?
That's a book.
I mean, are you reading them, or are you just kind of like? We can move on.
I mean, you're
reading them. I'll just take your word.
I try to Deepak Chopra.
Yeah.
What's that amazing female monk? When Things Fall Apart. Pema Chodron. Yeah.
Very good.
Yeah. So anyway, my friends who play Scrabble with me. Yeah, Pema Chodron. Yeah, she's. I think the first female monk.
Oh.
Tibetan monk, the first something like that, the first Western
female
Tibetan monk or something, and she's great. So her books,
So these are inspirational.
Yeah, and trying to cultivate
a certain spirituality in your life,
centering. Yes, a meditative.
It's so funny because it's so
that I'm terrible at.
Yeah, but that's not the point, right?
Well, I had a revelation after 35 years of meditating.
Is this TM or is this?
No, it's like just I've tried everything, but just really sitting and counting my breaths. And if I get to counting to 10, with 10 being the goal, and if I have a thought, I have to go back to 1. And so in 35 years, I've never made it to 2. Because whenever I get to 2, I go, oh my God, I made it to 2, and that's a thought, and I have to go back to 1.
So the idea is to be free of thought and just focusing
on breathing. Well, when they come, let them just move on like a cloud and don't attach to them, don't get into a story, don't run off on this with the story of it.
I see.
Because the thing you try to bar, you're just inviting. So the idea of trying to don't have a thought is just going to invite it. Listen, what do I know? I can't even get to 2. But I just had a revelation after 35 years because I'm really good at 1. Breathe in and breathe out 1.
Okay.
I thought, what if 10 wasn't the goal? What if 1 was the goal?
Uh-huh.
And I just go 1, 1, 1.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel like I've come up with a genius idea.
Yeah, well, you succeed every time you do the meditation.
That's right, and I can do 1. So maybe that's the new. I mean, listen, if I do 3 minutes a day, 5 minutes a day, anything counts,
Sure, sure.
And running, we were talking about running. I feel running.
Yes.
I felt right. very meditative, even though yeah. I'm listening to music and
yeah.
stuff.
Yeah. I just have to I have to figure out the tendonitis thing and because I'm really missing it, and it's the only thing that works that I'm really committed to. And there was a period.
We have similar bodies. We're like Scottish stock legs.
Right? Right. Yeah, yeah. Thick kind of thick, naturally strong. Muscular, but not.
Opposite for running. Opposite made for running. Like, we don't have runner. We have, like, identical non-runner bodies.
It's true.
Bodies.
Right. Not long, like, it's these sinewy. Right.
Fucking
no.
That's Ethiopian.
True. That's true.
Right.
Okay. So, we're speaking with Eric Schaefer. Finally, make the.
That was an excellent.
It was a good intro.
You didn't know
that was the
now.
Preamble. Yeah. But, you know, I mean, truthfully, I do an intro, just so you know, you understand. And for some reason, no matter where things go. It always just makes sense. You know what I mean? It always works out exactly right. Yeah. So, and sometimes I'm surprised, you know, you have one of these kind of weird feels. Like while you're doing the podcast, it feels like it's a little weird, a little disorganized. And then you listen to it, it's like, no, this is really ends up being compelling talk, you know? So have you done many podcasts or?
No, I haven't. I've only done a couple. And what you just said was interesting, though, because that I find is actually sort of speaks to your skill as a creative person as a podcaster, in the same way that I feel like when you've honed a skill, often you're kind of going on fumes sometimes, and you think, I know I find this in filmmaking.
Yeah, yeah.
That you'll think, just like you described, that
you got nothing.
It's all over the place, and then it just doesn't. It all sort of creatively works. And I think that's not by accident. I think that's because you've honed a skill at what you're doing.
All right, I'll go with that. I like that.
Although I don't like that I'm smelling pot now. That's really not good. Like, they're fucking smoking a big joint right there. That's really annoying.
Does it really bother you?
Huh?
Really bothers you?
Yeah.
Oh, because, yeah. Yeah, you don't want to.
Yeah.
That second.
And it looks like it's the
And we're downwind. We're downwind. I'm happy to move.
Can we?
Sure.
Yeah. Sorry, man.
No, don't be sorry.
Can we keep talking while we move?
Yeah, that's a good idea.
Let's keep talking. We're now moving because
we're gonna
smelling like a big pot joint.
We are in.
Look at these. See, these are professional runners. See, look, this lady has the perfect runner's body.
Oh my gosh!
Body. She's
right.
like 5'11".
Well,
that's not true, actually. She's.
Yeah. Yeah. Fuck
all
it.
Right, let's go.
Here come the cops. We could actually do a citizen's arrest.
Yeah. Or as if at least, they care like, about pot smoking.
Yeah. Right.
You know what I mean? They'd be like, "Are you kidding me?" Let's go to that bench over there. Can
okay.
we?
Yeah. We could also do double Dutch, by the way, while we're.
That's hilarious.
No, I have to lift that though.
Yeah, I got it. Okay. We're wrangling.
Because I heard the scraping.
So anyway, so I think it's true, you know, that you...
Now you're going to get the sausage fumes.
Yeah, well, that'll... Yeah, the sausage cart will overpower the pot smoke.
It's more
this
ice
is where,
cream
right
than
here, where actually, I feel very bad, but it was a different time in the 70s.
By the way, over there.
And there was a Korean boy, the one Korean boy that lived in the neighborhood, and right there, at that part of Riverside Park on 100th Street, I tried to convince him that this little dirt square I had made was a brownie, and he knew it was not a brownie. We were probably both 6 or 7, and he just didn't want to take a bite. And I was just, we all applied such peer pressure.
Mm-hmm.
It's a brownie. I guarantee you it's a chocolate brownie. And he so clearly knew it was not. And finally he took a bite. It was not my finest moment at all. And we all made fun of him. It was just not good. It was awful. Kids are so awful.
Yeah. We all do it. My worst moment, I still remember, very young, and I think I took I was either hit a kid or I pushed him up against something, and he chipped a tooth. And
yeah.
I mean, that's just so not
no,
me,
I know.
Even
no,
then.
No, not at all.
I don't know why I would have.
So, clearly, 50 been, years later, I'm remembering it, and every time I run by here, I literally remember it and feel bad. I hope I could meet him and make an apology to him.
It's not going to happen. You have to forget.
That's
yourself.
Why the whole bullying thing now. I'm all for it. Because I didn't understand in high school, in grade school, why no one was sticking up for me.
Mm-hmm.
Why my parents wouldn't go to school and get someone arrested for how they were bullying me. I mean, but I will say, having said that, the kind of shit and bullying that I went through as a kid, being on the bullied end of things, made convincing someone to eat a piece of dirt brownie was nothing. You know?
It's just dirt.
Yeah, it was just dirt.
No, don't worry about it.
Yeah. That's not too bad. Okay.
No, there's worse.
Yeah, I felt awful.
Things
I felt awful then, and I felt awful clearly for subsequent half a century.
I don't think you can die from that or get sick.
No, I just felt bad. The idea of, because I've been humiliated so many times when I was a kid, you know. And
I guess I learned really young humor was just so effective. being funny and being not the class clown, but doing impressions of the teachers, all those things really just, you know, and then it also kind of kept, it became a device over many years of course, breaking the ice socially and feeling comfortable, but it became part of, like, the way I would also, I could distance myself on a certain level also. So then I went through this rejection of it, trying not to kind of be more serious, and then just said, what do I care? You know, like, come full circle in a way and realize that's just part of who I am. You know,
yeah, I've just always been super sensitive. Like, you know, people, I have a lot of friends that are like, hey, let it roll off your back. And I'm just always been a super sensitive kid and person.
I like that. I like you already.
Listen, when you write, direct, act, and produce movies, you know, it's, you know, you're really out front and center, obviously.
Yeah. And so you're going to be a target.
Yeah. And there's going to be, it's art. It's an artistic endeavor. So people are going to either, and I make stuff that's very, I don't know. Has a real points of view about stuff, and it's dangerous to some, and liberating to others. And so, you know, I guess I'm not saying I wouldn't want it any other way. I don't look at it objectively. I look at it intensely subjectively. I just do what feels like a story I want to tell, and I know that I'm just an average person. Mm-hmm. So I know there's going to be millions of other average people that identify, and that's how I operate. So there's no sense of, it's very myopic in that respect in terms of what I choose to do. So, but I'm smart enough to understand that there are plenty of people that then are going to feel threatened or just not like it, not think it's funny, not think it's smart, not think it's interesting. And, you know, and with social media and the way that, you know, people get their information now and how many people can get their points of view and opinions out there into the world, there are a lot of points of view and opinions now about everything, including art, whereas before, in the years past, it was harder to get your art out and harder to get opinions about that art out.
Yeah.
And so people can determine whether, you know, there's good and there's not so good in that paradigm.
And you're... trajectory as a filmmaker really has been over that course of that time of where
totally
I mean it's all been through, and in fact I mean in some ways, you know, the speed of not only just the advent of social media but also just how quickly film distribution has been evolving, all these things, it's like sped up. So, and you've been making film and to some degree taking advantage also of certain parts of the evolution. For instance, you know, doing the reality TV show.
I like to call it a documentary series.
Documentary series? Okay.
Yes. I'm joking because I watch it was so almost really, solely reality TV on television.
Yeah.
But in the old days, it's so funny because we would have called it a documentary series. If you follow a guy doing whatever, a woman doing anything, running around the country, we would have called that a docu-series. Anyway, I'm kidding you. Yes, reality documentary, whatever.
Kardashians changed all that, or maybe it was Big Brother. I don't know, but, you know, it all. But that was, I mean, I don't know if you're listening and you have not seen the series, I Can't Believe I'm Still Single, but very addictive, very entertaining stuff.
Thanks. Yeah, you know, that I'm always amazed at who has even seen my stuff, let alone who might like it. And it's always fun that... that series, I guess there are a lot of people that hang out, you know, like me, like that's what I mean, that watching Showtime, it happened to be on at 11 or 11:30 or midnight when it was on.
I was able to binge watch that much, I know, so I don't
remember. Well, then it came on like on demand.
On demand because I just couldn't stop. I kept going. So whoever
But I've run into the most interesting people from Mike DeLuca to Jeffrey Tambor that were like, you know what I loved you? I'm like, what? They're like, that show where you're like going cross country. And I said, really?
On a book tour.
I feel good about it, yeah. Well, because, again, it's just a dude out there, a human being a human being. And I had a lot of fun with that series, and I think that it's, again, that, you know, that was series that was in 2008, 9, and 10, which isn't that long ago, but so much has changed with streaming and with social media in the last 7 years, just in 2010, that if that were on now, I think a whole lot more people would have seen it.
It's never too late to pick it up. But
yeah, it was on Hulu for a while, too, and then they just discontinued it, along with a lot of stuff. They sort of, because there's so much content coming out, they can't keep stuff on there for that long.
And I guess, that's a whole other conversation, I mean, just in terms of the sheer, like, how you get your stuff to be noticed amidst so much else, but that's not really the point of this conversation. So I only wrote down because I realized that it had been a while. I've seen a number of your films as they've come out, you know, and
back when people went actually to the movie theater to watch a movie.
That, certainly, but also just, you know, or just this, that it came out. Some of them I'm sure I saw either on cable or, you know, on DVD or then streamed. I don't know. But when I started to look back at some of the films and looked at the like the cast, I was like, first of all, I do remember My Life's in Turnaround at a time when I kind of was becoming an adult, forming my own opinions about film. Right as your career was, you know, you just started with that film, and that was during that period when there was a new generation of filmmakers making indie film, and obviously all of a sudden all the majors had these, you know, indie film houses, right? You know, and you were part of that whole movement of filmmakers. So that was like one of those films I saw because everybody was talking about that one, and you know, and we mentioned Tom DiCillo on the way down here, who's been on here a couple of times. So there was, you know, his films and all the, you know, Hartley and...
Yeah, it was the early to mid-90s. It was, you know, and a big sort of godfather of getting a lot of those films out was John Pearson, you know, who helped fund it at, with his company, you know, working at Islet. A lot of... He gave us finishing money for that movie along with Clerks, She's Gotta Have It, Brothers Mc... Not, I don't know, Brothers McMullen, Go Fish, you know, like... All these sort of seminal...
You can read his book about this whole thing. And he mentions in that book, actually, Spike Dyke...
Spike Dyke, Dykes, and whatever it's called,
He mentions... He does talk about it, and he says that he had kind of promised he would not be... didn't want to take on a film about... movie about making a movie, you know? Do you remember that? And yet he still did it, and he was glad he did.
Yeah. Donnie really spent a lot of time talking to John more than I did, just because I don't forget why. And John really liked it, but was hesitant, and then finally pulled the trigger, which we're really, I'm eternally grateful for. You know, we were, I think, one of the first sort of movies about making a movie that got out there.
Absolutely.
And people seem to, you know, because I think it's, you know, it's more about friendship and these two guys and dreams coming true and setting out in your 20s to try to make your dreams come true. The backdrop was that we were making a film to do that.
Right.
But I think the heart of the film really was, you know, sort of an eternal bromance story of going after your dreams in your 20s. So I think that appealed to a lot of people more so than it didn't feel like you had to be sort of on the end of filmmaking or know about films to like it.
Yeah. So how did you, just to start it off, how did you think you could make a film?
It's funny. So I drove a cab for 8 years.
Oh, yeah.
I was driving a taxi. I was writing.
Like a yellow cab?
Yeah, like a yellow cab for 8 years, full time, not weekends. I mean,
you
it was like, I was, I was driving for 50
still,
hours
had you,
a week.
Had you, I'm sorry to interrupt you, Eric. I apologize. One of my.
No.
But were you still an addict at that time? Or?
No, I got sober when I was a junior in college.
Okay.
So I got.
At Bard?
Yeah, Bard.
The last place I went there, too. The last place you. It's easy to get sober there. I mean, it's not so
Easy. Well, yeah, I just was lucky enough to stop drinking and drugging my junior year of college, and I've been lucky enough to stay sober since. And
we overlapped, I bet.
When were you there?
Yeah. 82.
You left in 82?
Well, I guess 2 years younger.
Oh, so.
And
so I graduated in 84.
Yeah, so you were there in 80. So we were there
Amazing.
Living in
oh my God.
Annandale and Hudson, the same
Amazing.
Time.
Amazing, yeah, I was living in Tivoli. So, you know, I drove the cab for 8 years, and I was like a heat-seeking missile and wanting to make films, you know. But back in the 80s, it was like this big spec script boom. So it was all about write a spec script, and you can sell it for $1 million, and you can make them. And I figured that was the way I had most control as a writer. As an actor or director, you need someone to give you a job. But I felt like writing I could do.
Right.
I could write the script and then try to find money to go make the film. So for 8 years, I would write. I would drive for 50 hours a week and write for 50 hours a week. So I would, and I wrote 20 scripts, a book, which I didn't sell, but became Wiry Spindel, a film that I made 10 years later. I couldn't sell the book, and couldn't get arrested. And I was driving the cab, and I was just heartbroken because I so badly wanted to make a film, but I didn't know how to connect the dots, you know. And I didn't. Just personality-wise, I wasn't the kind of person that wanted to work my way up on a film set. just for my I wanted to step foot on a film set when I was a writer, director, star, producer.
Did you have any role models for that? Had you seen anybody do that? I mean, I guess
Just Woody Allen, you know, was a writer, director.
John Sayles.
Yeah.
There's a few people knocking around Cassavetes,
right.
But even that.
Right.
He did was doing such
No, I really just knew that's what I wanted to do.
Right.
Just because I liked all those things. I liked to act. I liked to write it. Uh-huh. I wanted to direct it. I just had a complete vision for it.
Right.
So then I was turning 30. I was heartbroken. I was disillusioned. I'd worked my ass off. Couldn't get close. And then this movie called Laws of Gravity came out, which was made by Nick Gomez and these guys at the shooting gallery. And it was like a $40,000 movie to begin with, and then got finishing funds. No movie that's on film back then was ever could only be $40,000 to blow it up from 16mm cost more than that. So,
okay.
You know, but anyway, it came out. It was at the Waverly. I was like, I knew those guys. I said, well, if they
can... Now the IFC Center.
If they can do that, I can scrounge together a couple $1,000s. So I moved home with my mother at 30. I saved money, ran it to Donnie Ward, an old friend of mine. He was feeling the same way. We got together. We sat in the Broadway diner on 101st Street in Broadway with a yellow legal pad and started writing the script. Martha Plimpton walked in because she lived in the neighborhood. I walked up to her and said, will you be in this movie we're writing over in that booth? She said, sure.
Had you ever met her before?
No.
No,
I just walked up to her. Then I picked up Phoebe Cates in my cab and asked her to be in it. And she said, basically, sure. And so then Donnie's great-grandfather, great-uncle was Ring Lardner, or Ring Lardner Sr. or Jr.
What?
I get it mixed up.
Is that true?
Yeah.
Well, the Pinko one.
I forget.
The Ring
famous,
Lardner,
amazing writer
who
wrote MASH and all
yeah.
that. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so
he's
John Sayles had played him in Eight Men Out.
Oh,
so
okay.
Donnie approached, Donnie wrote John Sayles saying, hey, this is incredible, totally cool. You played my grandfather, uncle. I'm sorry, I forget which it is.
Oh, right.
And John Sayles was like, that's great. Sure, I'll be in your movie. So we scrounged together like $17,000 from mm-hmm. friends and family and me moving home and saving my money from the cab. And so we had enough to shoot this film. And the first scene we ever shot was the John Sayles scene where he plays this smarmy producer.
Right.
And the rest is history. And so I just knew we could make it because I knew, even though I'd never set foot on a film set, I had acted a lot. I had written a lot of plays.
Sure. I understand.
In my mind.
You had a vision.
Yeah.
I understand.
Yeah.
It's like 30 years of building, creating a story in your head and a method of storytelling.
Yeah, and I had a clear vision in my head.
Yeah,
and as we
like
say
17.
In the movie, you just hire
somebody to
buddy
hold the
else
camera?
To point the camera. And
yeah,
stuff.
Exactly. Yeah. So what were you thinking as you stood there behind that guy pointing the camera? And there's
well,
John.
Well, I wasn't. I was acting in the scene.
Oh, so, right. You know, of course.
So
what were you thinking sitting across from John Sayles? I just.
Well,
just
we cried. I mean, I pulled up. I'll never forget it. We were driving Donnie's like beat up Dodge Omni. And we shot it at J.G. Mellon's on 74th or 5th in Amsterdam, uh-huh. That bar, because he knew people, so that somehow they let us shoot there. So it was 5 in the morning, earlier than I'd ever gotten
nobody
up,
said
except
no
when
to you.
I was up from Coke binges, you know, but I was sober at that point. 5 in the morning with a bagel, juggling a bagel and a coffee, and we rounded the corner, and there was already a little tiny truck with people, like, taking film equipment off it, like shiny brass stands. I didn't
right.
even know what they were for, but I'd seen them
yeah.
on film sets. And I was so shocked. I was like, how did they know to get here before us and start setting up? And Donnie's like, I don't know. The producer we got is like, does all that. Or maybe Donnie did know. I didn't know.
Yeah.
And I just remember having chills that this was the most exciting thing that had ever happened to me.
And it was just the exactly right. You were in the right place. And there was no better or more perfect place for you to be in the world right
now. Oh, my
then.
God. Are you kidding?
Right?
It was nirvana. It was incredible.
Yeah, right.
And we walked in and John Sayles shot the first scene. He sort of probably helped us direct it, sort of. And
yeah.
we're sitting there, and it was just, I'll never forget it. It was, because it was also this culmination of a dream that I had worked so hard for 10 fucking years
yeah.
driving that cab and not getting anything. And then finally we sort of made it happen again with the help of a lot of people. So it was kind of like manifest destiny. I mean, in a respect, it felt like it was always meant to be and that I knew it would always happen, but it also felt like a dream come true. And that's how my whole life has felt. I've always felt and expected it to happen, but that hasn't meant that it has felt any less miraculous when it has. So it's that weird kind of both things operating at the same time. Mm. And a sense that a fear that it will never, ever happen again every time I don't have a job, which is a lot of the time.
Right, which I guess is a very common experience. And then you have to have that voice, I hope, that knows better. And
yeah, like blinders. You have
you've
to
gone
just,
through this before and go
well, right,
by
I think
past,
I read a thing yeah. like that people that have made $1 million before uh-huh. have a thousand times percentage higher chance of, if they lose it, to make another million
than
someone who's never made,
made it.
Yes, because
right.
they just have a sense that they've done it.
Right, and it's achievable.
And that there's abundance in the world
yeah.
instead of a sense of lack. And I've been lucky enough to make $1 million, but and I've lost it. Well, I don't lose it. I sink it all, and I never save any
I
of it.
I understand. You turn it
I put it into a movie because the one thing we talked about was the one thing in the 80s and 90s that you had to shoot on 35 millimeter. You could make a film on 60 millimeter to kind of get
yeah.
on it like we
do. Duart.
Yes, yeah,
that does
like
it.
My Life's in Turnaround. But then once you did that, mm-hmm. then you'd want to shoot on 35 millimeter, and really you could, that
oh, right.
you couldn't do for less than $300,000-$600,000.
Right. Well, fortunately, I guess your next the next one, if right, was if Lucy Fell.
Yeah. So then
I don't know why she's ignoring me.
Yeah,
she's,
My Life's in Turnaround, and that sort of
it was
luckily,
3.5 million.
Got, what?
That was the 3.5. I don't normally talk numbers, but
yeah, yeah.
I'm
well,
just trying to point. I don't normally get stuck on those types of budgets and stuff, but I think it's very, it is an interesting and exciting that you go from, what'd you say, 40,000?
Yeah, well, we put it in the can for 40,000, and then John gave us finishing money, so it was 200,000
so
totally.
It into you could blow
yes.
it up and all that. And
but
then,
it was like,
yeah.
You know, come on. It was, and so
but
then,
to go from that, just to show the contrast
yeah.
to 3.5 million.
No, it felt like for, David Lean money. It
right.
felt like
yeah.
literally we had, I had, $3.5 million for If Lucy Fell, but 2.2 below the line. So the 1.5 went to like CAA packaging fees.
Below the line.
Below the line means basically for the nuts and bolts to actually make your film, to hire actors, to hire crew members, to hire the trucks, to rent the camera. That's all the nuts and bolts of making your film.
Before you turn on the camera. All that stuff that's
well, no,
all
even,
set up.
No, even when
production.
You turn on the camera, yeah.
Okay.
All production.
Mm-hmm.
Above the line is what you pay the producer.
I see.
The actors. What you pay the salaries, and CAA took a packaging fee of like $500,000 just to put it all together.
Oh, I see. So they were all CAA actors.
Yes. I was with CAA at that point.
Right. Makes sense.
Ben Stiller, so was Sarah
right.
Jessica Parker.
Sarah Jessica Parker was in it.
And yeah. then, you know, I gave Scarlett Johansson her first or second movie role as a 10-year-old. I'm still waiting to make that call. I have not called her. I
yeah.
bumped into her. But I'm waiting till I have really the perfect movie for her because I feel like that only might be one call.
Oh, where you're going to say, you're
hey,
coming
Scarlett,
back. Yeah.
Remember
now,
me?
Yeah. It's payback time, baby.
It's not paid. Like, listen, she's,
okay,
you know, I did nothing for her, and she
I
was
understand.
Amazing.
She would have made it no matter what.
Yes.
Is that
but,
kind of thing?
But, to say,
but
hey,
she was
Scarlett,
also back. You also did, she was in a second film?
Yeah, she had a little
part
role
of Fall.
In Fall.
Right.
And she
okay.
was, you know, you
did
could
you
tell
see
she
it?
Was special.
Really? Okay. Because when I mean,
oh,
I
no,
didn't, I don't remember, even though I saw those, I don't remember her until, of course, Ghost World.
Yeah,
but I you know,
oh, no,
I have
she
to go
was.
Back.
You
I
could tell she
back.
Was special, you
yeah.
know, for sure.
People always say that about me. I don't know what yeah. that they meant. Something else, perhaps. Oh, and, you know, and Bill Sage, who's a friend, was in that. Of course,
he's great. Well, yeah,
you
I must
pilfered
say I've
the
been
Hal
lucky.
Hartley stable in that film too.
Well, I've been. It is kind of you know I've been lucky, or I guess I've been lucky that great actors have walked in front of me, and I've been. Lucky enough to recognize or think they're really great mm-hmm. when they're earlier in their careers.
Yeah.
You know, from, you know, the last Emmys award show, like five of my sort of Eric alumni, Sterling Brown was in
uh-huh.
Starved.
Uh-huh.
He's the amazing actor who's gone on to win Emmys for This Is Us and I think the OJ FX show. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, Scarlett, obviously, and Elizabeth Reeser was in Mind the Gap, and
mm-hmm.
she's gone on to do amazing things. But these are just amazing actors that happen to walk in, and I happen to get lucky and cast them when they were earlier in their careers.
But how did you feel? Well, I guess you had worked with Phoebe Cates, as you mentioned, and Martha Plimpton, a couple of other, and John. So maybe by the time you got to If Lucy Fell, you weren't too intimidated by the idea of Ben Stiller and directing.
Well, I had picked up Sarah Jessica.
Very big.
Well, listen.
Yeah.
We made My Life's in Turnaround, and then we got CAA. It came out. We got a good New York Times review. Kind of people. It was buzzy. People heard about it, and then we went to CAA, and we had Donnie and I had written another script, and we kind of like got it set up at TriStar with these big producers, and we wanted to, of course, be in it, write it, and direct it. And they said, we won't let you be in it, but we'll let you direct it. And they said, so we cast Ben Stiller. That's how we met Ben. Mm-hmm. And Mark Canton, the head of TriStar, said, if you cast any of the Baldwins in the other role, it's a greenlit movie. Any of them. Billy, Alec.
Doesn't matter. Even one that's not, that doesn't exist.
And Donnie kind of knew them from Long Island, and Billy said no, and like Alec sort of wasn't, he was off doing bigger things. And then the other one said no, and Steven said no. Right. And
what's the big one that's crazy? I don't know. That describes a few of them, actually.
But so we were on the like 1 yard line. We had a budget, $10 million budget. We were going to be able to direct it. It was about to be greenlit. And then it didn't happen. It fell apart. And I realized, oh, that's what happens. And I could choose to, if I'm lucky, probably have a very lucrative career writing stuff, getting put on projects, but never make another movie. Mm-hmm. And I just spent 10 years in the fucking cab, and we made my life a turnaround. I'm not going to let, I don't want to do that.
Yeah.
I'd rather do it on, I'd rather go make another $15,000 movie.
Sure.
So I said, I'm making it If Lucy Fell. And so I had written If Lucy Fell. I met, okay. So before I made My Life's in Turnaround, I had had one stint in Hollywood with an agent I got who had introduced me. I had two meetings, and one of them was Molly Ringwald. And I had been up for Ducky as an actor.
Oh,
the lead in that, but didn't get it. So, and of course, like everyone, I was in love with Molly Ringwald.
Yeah,
and,
sure.
And I had almost got Ducky in Pretty in Pink as an actor because Betty Buckley, who I knew, had like, knew Howie Deutsch, who directed it, and got me an audition when I didn't have an agent. But then I got an agent. Before I made My Life's in Turnaround, I was a cab driver, but I had two meetings. One was Molly Ringwald. Long story short, I went because I looked pasty and I wanted to have a nice suntan to meet Molly. So I got my baby oil and went to Malibu for 2 hours, put it all over my face except for my nose and my mouth. I put on sunblock, and I showed up for my Molly meeting with a beet red lobster face and a white nose and a white ring around my
mouth.
This
came back, right? This
I did that in If Lucy Fell.
Lucy Fell,
I put
right.
In If Lucy Fell.
That's what now I'm remembering.
Yeah, Molly laughed, ha ha ha, but I felt she liked me, and I asked her out, and she said yes, and we started dating. I wrote If Lucy Fell for her. We ended up not being able to set it up for her. I went back to the cab, made My Life's in Turnaround. The story I just told you happened where we almost made another movie but didn't, and I said, I want to make If Lucy Fell. So at that point, I had picked up Sarah Jessica Parker in my cab years earlier, met her at a party. We had the same agent now at CAA. I said, I don't know if you remember me, but I picked you up in 86 in Columbus and took you to 22nd. And she's like, yeah, that makes sense. I used to go to a little coffee shop there.
Yeah.
I sent it to her. She said, yes, she'd do it. We had met Ben Stiller because of the movie that fell apart. So CAA packaged it. I cast Elle, and those were the days where CAA could just go, yeah, we'll get you $3 million to make it.
Yeah, right.
By tomorrow, they did, and I made it Flussy Fell. But again, it was like just the film 35mm is so thick and fat and luxurious, and it really felt like you were a real filmmaker,
right?
Because you had this thick film,
yeah, right?
60mm was this thin. Independent film, you know, in a bad way, but you just felt like
it does represent, right?
Oh God, it was so
much. It's
incredible.
Yeah, interesting. I never thought about it.
And I had movie trucks like you see, on the street with trailers
for the stars.
Not many, but there
did you have a trailer for the first time?
We didn't have the budget, and I would never be in it because I was writing, directing, producing it. So.
Well, you still okay. I'm sure you've had a trailer.
No, we didn't, because I was like, I don't need one. And I came from the world of independent filmmaking, which is like, I don't
want money. But that's another thing.
Wasteful money. Right, I don't want to spend wasteful money.
Yeah. But that's another thing that's changed a lot, because you say you came from independent film, but you made, well, you've gone back and forth, truthfully, right? Because
the biggest budget film I ever made. Well, TV shows I've made have been bigger budget.
Right, that's true.
I mean, like Starved and Gravity, we had.
Which you were, go ahead.
Still had relatively no money next to what they make real, you know, big budget TV shows for. But, you know, we had budgeted $600,000 for a half hour episode, and we did 10 of them. Mm-hmm. So I had $6 million to do basically 10 half hours or a 5 hour movie. So, but in New York City, again, that's nothing. So that was speed filmmaking. I mean, we would shoot a 25 minute episode in 2.5 days.
Right.
I mean, it was literally racing around.
And you were doing that though in
No, it was all here.
It was here? It was
all here.
Okay. That's a hole in my knowledge about you, because I haven't had a chance to see those series.
Oh, really? Starved, you never saw, or Gravity?
I didn't.
They're good. If you're interested, I'll send you. Yeah,
I am interested. I want to see
Starved,
that.
It was Sterling Brown was in, and Laura Benanti. And,
right, you mentioned.
Really cool, dark, edgy half hour about people with eating disorders. That was on FX.
Yeah. So since you brought it up, because we started talking about food and eating and all,
yeah.
And it's of course a through line, if you will, that goes through almost everything you've written,
yeah.
Right? So you're very open and honest about it, right?
Yeah.
Struggles
with food. Yeah.
Food. And now I have to ask you: do you really, just for my own information, I have to know? Are you night snack eater?
Yeah, I'm a night eater. I'm a night eater. Night cake. Yeah, I'm a night eater. I've gotten much better at that over the last 4 or 5 years.
A lot of people go through. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. No. Luckily, eating disorders are brutal, and my heart goes. I have experience with alcohol and drug addiction, but like food, alcohol and drugs, you don't need any of that to live, to survive. You can just cut it out of your life.
Oh, right.
But food.
Not
you
so much.
You need sustenance, right? So, like, the agent of your addiction is something that you must have to survive.
Yeah.
It's awful. It's brutal. So, luckily, I'm not bulimic or anorexic completely, sort of definitively,
mm-hmm.
but I have a disordered relationship to eating.
Understood.
I think, like most people, mm-hmm. that don't rise to the level of bulimia or anorexia where it gets life-threatening.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm obsessed with my weight, obsessed with, counting calories, counting fat points, robbing Peter to pay Paul. If I don't eat throughout the day, then I set myself up to binge. So like all that kind of stuff that I think, I don't know what percentage, 90, I feel like 90% of us do.
Yeah. But all that would be fine if you didn't feel guilty.
I don't feel guilty.
Or self.
No, I don't feel guilty.
Oh, you don't
feel
guilty?
No, I just.
So what's the problem?
The problem is that I don't feel healthy.
Mm-hmm.
I want to feel healthy and I can't, and I boomerang, okay. or whatever you call it, between like 30 and 40 pounds.
Really?
Yeah. And so, but I've gotten, listen, the last 5 or 6
too,
years,
actually,
I've gotten a lot of health around it. I've gotten much better.
Mm-hmm.
Weight Watchers has really helped me.
Really?
And so the night eating, I've kind of don't do anymore for the last 4 or 5 years. Weight Watchers has been amazing because I like numbers.
Yeah.
And I like discipline.
Right. Yeah. It's all about the numbers. It's all
so
about
it's just sort of like
track of numbers.
Yeah.
That's it.
And I can eat whatever I want in terms of kinds of foods.
Mm-hmm.
I just have to eat.
They're
have
not
portion
about,
control.
Right. They're not about denying yourself.
No, it's just a matter.
That's the
yeah.
always
right.
been the.
Yes, as an addict, obviously.
Yeah.
If I'm saying no, you can't have that. I'm just gonna. That's all I'm gonna want.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, it's been a constant struggle. But as I say, the last 5 or 6 years, I've had a lot of health around it, a lot of recovery around eating more normally. And
that's
more
a lot of years to go through. That sounds like decades of a struggle, regardless,
absolutely.
Right? Which is like stays with you for.
Yeah.
Can stay with you. Quite a while. Maybe you can
yeah,
let
well, it's
go.
Still, it's a daily, it's yeah. a.
But it's just come up so much in the films. It's not even that it's come up, but it's like your choice to put it out there.
Well, because I just put out what's in my life. I just put out what's true to me.
Right.
Again, feeling like I'm just a normal, average, run-of-the-mill human being.
Uh-huh.
And so I feel like.
People will relate?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and especially as a man, I think that's, the press for eating issues is way more. In the feminine camp,
sure,
absolutely. When I think, again, being just a normal run-of-the-mill guy.
Yeah.
All the things. That's why I like to, being in touch with certain emotions and being, my life's in turnaround, giggling about and opining and being obsessed with the answering machine message that I'm waiting for a girl to call.
Mm-hmm.
I think a lot of women are like, oh my God, guys do that? It's like, of course we do.
Right.
Sort of the things that are obvious to us as men, knowing that are obvious to me and us as men that don't get a lot of press, I think that's something I like to write about
mm-hmm.
because I feel like where there's sort of secrecy, there's danger for people. I feel like if the one service I can bring to the world is illuminating what's natural about our condition,
mm-hmm.
That would be a great service. I don't know if I can, but people have reported that through their identification with some of my habits, they feel sort of like, wow, I thought I was a freak, basically, for either sexually, right. emotionally, right. mentally having these thoughts and feelings, and I feel like I'm not because you've expressed the same thing, mm-hmm. you know?
Yeah. So, and then of course the other subject being sex, but I guess I'm wondering if. So that too, is it liberating just to put it out there and then just sort of just grapple, you know, with it and just, you know, like a kind of almost aggressively take on these subjects in a public way? Is it liberating? And then like living transparent. I assume that's also another big part of your.
Well, what's liberating about it isn't taking like sort of again objectively. Like I don't think wow, I'm going to take on a subject. Like it's not an objective.
It's
sort
just
of
you.
Intention.
It's just you. It's just being.
It's a story. I sit down. I go, oh, what story do I want to write? And it's so subjective because I don't think about what anyone else will like, mm-hmm. what will work in the marketplace. I think Robert Altman once said, all he can do is trust his art and hope that from time to time it matches up with popular opinion.
Right.
But who knows?
Yeah.
If what you do is going to work in the marketplace. So I just sit down and go, what's important to me to write as a story that I want to just write right now? Mm-hmm. And I write it. And I think sort of almost retrospectively, it seems. So what's liberating is watching it in the back with an audience and feeling them identify mm-hmm. through laughter, through if they get upset, you know, not in a bad way, but in a way, in any way.
I understand. They're just feeling.
Yes.
Whether, I mean, feelings
having,
are.
Right.
Good, no matter
that's what's liberating.
Right.
Because then I feel again, like, I just know that I've felt so disenfranchised. So separated, so like I'm a fucking freak, and like I'm unloved, unlovable, that whenever I can feel like a kinship with another human being, mm-hmm. that's so healing to me, and not feel like I'm awful. And so I feel like other people must feel like that too. Like
right.
it'd be nice to feel like we're not a freak. And so that's what's liberating, but I never look at it objectively. When I look at it objectively, that's when I get scared off because then I'm letting other people's opinions.
Yeah.
And the people
and that's
that,
terrifying for any artist trying to
yeah.
be a truth teller.
Yeah. Because, right. and the people that don't look at it the way I do mm-hmm. and get threatened by it or don't like it, and then they sort of have their opinion, and that'll make me think, oh my God, I'm barking up the wrong tree or it's.
Yeah.
So.
So, yeah, have you really enjoyed festivals and opening weekends because you're doing the Q&As and you're meeting the audiences and you're having really...
Yeah, that's the best part of it for me. I mean, that's the only reason I do it, right? Because I don't want to, in a vacuum, I go hang around the back, not in any kind of like egocentric or like narcissistic way to watch the film 1,000 times. Uh-huh. I do it so I can commune and have the experience with the audience that's watching it mm-hmm. with 100 people, 50 people, 4 people in the dark in a movie theater.
Right. It's
right.
no secret. Yeah, I mean, it makes total sense that considering this, that you are putting yourself out there, you know, in the pretty brave way, you know, that you'd want to connect afterwards with people's experience, whether it's positive or negative. You know,
well,
hopefully positive.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, again, it's like I don't think of it. I appreciate you saying that. I mean, I don't think of it as brave or not. I just think of it as kind of like
gratifying.
Yeah, well, it's just what I do. I'm not ashamed. I'm so unashamed of the things that I'm ashamed and have regret for a certain way I've behaved. I've certainly learned a lot and act in a lot of dumb ways a lot of the time. But I'm not ashamed for my sort of feelings that I know don't harm anyone else.
Yeah.
Or my thoughts. Again, emotionally, mentally, sexually.
I'd love to give a great example of what you're talking about.
What
you did recently in the this web series that you did called... Eric Schaefer, life coach, is that?
Yeah.
Which I only discovered, oddly enough, because I'm pretty connected, but I only found when I started to try to, every periodically I'd say, I got to get Eric Schaefer on this podcast. I got to get him. And I think I tried around where Boy Meets Girl. And then, you know, I think I mentioned, and it, for whatever reason, it didn't happen. But, and then I went recently in the last few months, I started to try to catch up again, thinking, you know, knowing that we're going to sit, I guess. And, I watched this. I didn't know about it, but I found it. And there's this one long-winded way of saying there was one. There's this thing, this setup, which is this chair you sit in at the beginning of the day where, you know, you pleasure yourself. And but what's interesting is later on, I don't remember which episode, it was some episodes later, you're at the table and your dad Skypes you.
Yeah.
And you really connect with him. And it kind of comes out of nowhere. It comes as a surprise. And then you're like, you know, it's obviously, it's not really the time, but you're very moved. And because you didn't expect it. So, you know, it's just there's a nice moment where, you know, masturbation is now out of the question. Right. But it's like, for all the right reasons. I mean, it was just, this is my way of numbing my... I mean, because a lot of people, let's say, what is it, serial masturbators or sex addiction, where it's so much part of your preoccupation that it's often used to, like any other thing we've been talking about, as a way of numbing or, right?
I don't know that I don't think that character in Life Coach is a serial masturbator.
I don't know about you.
Once a day is, I feel like it's probably like... pretty normal for the American male.
Maybe you're right.
I don't know. If that's serial masturbation, then yes, I'm a proud member. But I think once a day.
I should correct myself somehow.
But I hear it. I know. Yes. I understand what you're saying.
But you know what it was that kind of maybe is the way I misinterpreted is because it was such a routine. It was such a setup as a ritual.
I know exactly what you're saying.
There's a ritual that you created, which is a little bit, you know, not necessarily typical, but. It was also a bit in a way. And so that was just a nice moment, you know, where you had
you
really like connected with your dad or the actor who plays the dad.
And you're right. I mean, there's been times, of course, whether it's eating or sex, whether it's wanting sex with a partner or masturbation, that it can be used as a deterrent to feeling what you're feeling.
Yeah.
Sometimes I think that's fine. And sometimes it might be more useful to me emotionally in my sort of emotional evolution to experience what I'm experiencing.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? And not eat the cake, full cake, not go have some sexual encounter with somebody else or with myself that's going to sort of get me away from feeling what I'm feeling. I think, again, that awful word moderation, you know, it's like sometimes I think it's completely fine. I want to go, I just need a break. I want to eat a couple pieces of cake. But when it makes me sick or when it makes me completely not look at my feelings that are behind it, then that's not helpful.
Right. Just for the record, I'm not a serial man.
You admitted.
I always say it because, well, you know, I have a child, and once I'm running around and I'm in the parental, because I don't live with him all the time, but there are sometimes weeks, and then when I'm not living with him, because I'm, you know, he's technically with his mother, but his mother's an actress who's on the stage, and there are sometimes I may have him for an extended period of time. And I don't like mixing that part of the conversation with my masturbation.
Yeah, no.
But there's a separation. But so when I found myself like alone for periods of time, all of a sudden there is a little bit more motivation to catch up. That's all.
Listen, I totally understand your point, and you're right.
It's like it's really been a long time, and you know, it's so nice to
listen. There was one time, and I remember I was in L.A. I would watch the Super Bowl with a couple friends, and I was very lonely and. I remember saying to my friend, I am going to go home and eat a lot of cake by myself tonight because I'm so sad. She said, why? I said, because I'm really sad and lonely. She said, why don't you just cry? I said, you know what? Oh. That's a good idea. I'm going to try that. And I went home, had a good cry, and didn't eat the cake. And so that's the obvious good version.
Maybe I should be crying.
Yeah. Well, and so obviously there are times that I've acted out sexually that out of loneliness that it didn't serve me. You know, I know that's what you're talking about. So, yes, in that moment... connecting with my father cured a kind of feeling that I might have tried to cover up.
That's
with,
what I got.
Whether it's food, sex. Right. I don't do drugs or drink anymore, but that's all sort of that's left for me is sex and food.
Yeah.
I don't rage. I don't overspend. I don't gamble to a debilitating degree.
You're young yet. You're young yet.
Yeah.
Not that I get so I don't care that much, but I do want to mention a couple of other people that you work with because I wanted to mention a couple more people that you worked with, even though it's a little step back. And one is like in you mentioned you wrote Wiry Spindel years ago, or rather 10 years before you made it. Let's put it that way. And then you wrote it as a book.
Yeah, I wrote it as a book. Sent it out. Nobody cared.
Okay.
Yes, so no, like I wouldn't have read it, but I wrote it.
To publishers, you mean?
Yeah, we sent it out to publishers, and everybody, you know, hated it.
Samantha?
I still remember some quotes from the rejection letters. I think the pseudo Brat Pack Mammoth-esque writing left me with an uncomfortable sense of deja vu. I think that was one. One of the rejection letter quotes. I take that as a compliment.
That's a rejection letter?
Yeah, I know.
It's like written for an audience almost, you know. But you know. But in that movie, my friend Samantha Buck is in it.
Samantha Buck?
Yeah.
Yeah, she was amazing.
She's been on this podcast,
she's
a producer and a director.
She was so good, yeah. Yeah, but, she's really good. she immortalized a certain girlfriend I had back at Bard. Mm-hmm. And her character in that role she played was based on a specific person I'd gone to college with. She was great. Yeah. She was perfect.
Anyway, so I just remember. I think I didn't know that when I was watching, until I started watching the film. Yeah, she's a friend, and she made a documentary with another friend of mine.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. A couple
Tell
years
her I said hi.
Next time I see her, I sure will. And then I was kind of curious. Oh, Yolanda Ross. She's been on the show, too.
She's great.
She
was amazing.
John Sayles, actually.
Yeah, yeah. I'm always so excited to see
this
people that are
the gap.
In my films, alumni, and that go on to do amazing things. I feel like a proud father.
Mind the Gap, right? That was Mind the Gap. And then also John Hurd was in that.
Yeah, John Hurd was in that, and he was also in Gravity.
Oh.
The TV show. He played Kristen Ritter's father.
So you must have gotten to know
Kristen Ritter
well.
Was in Gravity. A little bit, you know, not super well, but a little bit, and he was, you know,
it's like one of
so
guys.
Sad
yeah, I know.
That he died, and, you know, so young. And
I tried to, the other night, I was given a ticket. I ended up being really late, and then I heard she was the director of this one-off screening at the Quad, Joan Micklin-Silver. Mm-hmm. You've heard of her.
Yeah, of course.
And she worked with him on Chilly Scenes of Winter. And I wanted to have her on anyway because she's another just, you know, been around for so long. She's an older woman now, and she had worked with him, and I was thinking, oh, it would be nice to get her to talk about John Hurt because she must have, through the making of that film.
Yeah, he's just so good. I mean, you know, he's one of the people that I've worked with when he was already a very famous established actor.
Right.
Like Jeffrey Tambor, like Jill Klaber.
Yeah.
You know, I've been lucky. I mean, Ben Stiller and Sarah Jessica were certainly well-established and famous when I cast them in If Lucy Fell. It's not like Scarlett Johansson or Sterling Brown or Liz Reeser or some of the people that hadn't been as established. So I'm a fan.
Yeah,
so when I meet people and get to work with people like that that I've
Jill Klaver.
Been a fan of,
right?
You know, it's unbelievable. So yeah. John was in that category.
Sure. Yeah, makes sense. And I'm sure.
Yeah, I mean, these are people that are in, you know, in
those movies you grew up with.
Yeah.
First of all.
Yeah.
Like An Unmarried Woman, right?
Yeah, for Jill, yeah. Unmarried Woman, and for John Hurt, I mean, the list goes on and on. I mean,
right, yeah, of course.
What?
Just Home Alone. Although, maybe, I think we were already, already a filmmaker by then. Oh, and also in Starved, you worked with Neil Huff, who I know.
He's another,
well.
Another ridiculously amazing and talented actor.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's a good guy. He's been on here, too.
Yeah, he's fantastic. He played such a crazy role of a breatharian.
Of a what?
A breatharian, which is they're the people that believe that you shouldn't or don't have to eat any food, that you can get all your sustenance just from the sun.
Okay, I got
an air.
I really do have to.
So literally, but literally.
Oh, they do exist.
Yeah,
for real.
Yeah, no food or water. Well, no, maybe water, but sunlight and air. I mean, listen, I looked cursorily into it. I don't believe that's possible to live very long that way. I mean, I heard 3 days without water, you're dead, and maybe 50 days with food, you can live. But without food, whatever it is.
Is it a fasting, or are you saying?
No, it's a lifestyle.
This is a life commitment. And so no Debbie cakes, apparently.
Yeah, I don't think the breatharians eat Debbie cakes.
That's not part of
it. I don't think they do, but no Nemos. But
right.
But yeah, he played a breatharian, and like brilliantly.
Oh, I got to catch up. So please do, I don't know how you would make that available to me.
Starved?
Yeah,
Starved, unfortunately, isn't, it breaks my heart, but it's not, it's gettable on YouTube. People have downloaded it onto YouTube, but we could never put it out in any DVD or thing.
You mean like any of the platforms?
Right, because we didn't clear, because I love music so much, and I was lucky enough to get this amazing score from Mona Lisa's and Mad Hatter's, Elton John's song, to like all this incredible music that cost a lot, so we only could clear it for broadcast.
Understood.
We couldn't clear it for in perpetuity.
Perpetuity, right.
So the good news was I got this amazing score.
So how does it get on YouTube then if it has the songs?
People rip it off and illegally put it on there.
I know, but usually YouTube has the, you know, the algorithms or whatever it is in there that strips.
Yeah, luckily that hasn't happened. Yeah. So it's on YouTube.
All right, I'll check it out.
Yeah.
Unofficially.
I have a couple episodes I'm happy to send you on my Vimeo page, but I couldn't find them all.
All right. Also, did you make an unofficial or official sequel to My Life's?
Yeah, we made it. It's called They're Out of the Business.
Yeah,
Donnie and I made
a
sequel that IFC bought and put out.
How did I miss it?
It was 2011. Okay. And Yeah, it's Donnie and I 20 years later.
Right.
Same characters, mm-hmm. Splick and Jason, and mm-hmm. And the conceit is he's been writing his novel for 20 years mm-hmm. that he hasn't published. I've been off having my little independent film career and television show career, and I mm-hmm. get fired from my eating disorder show.
Right.
On XF, the station XF.
That's very subtle.
Yes. No. Listen, I'm very grateful that FX are putting my show on. But there's a joke about how my agent fires me. Everyone fires me. I'm mm-hmm. back in New York living with my mom, and I call him up and say, look, it's been 20 years. We must get together and make another movie. And he's like, stay away from me. And so the conceit is that we've had a falling out.
Okay. That's funny.
And I convince him yeah. that we should get back together and make another film.
One more.
And so since we already did the movie about making a movie, mm-hmm. even though the conceit is that we're going to get together and make another film, it's really about two guys in their 40s trying to sort of recreate their
sure.
lives.
They're both stuck.
Women.
And
relationships.
Right.
And so,
and they're estranged.
Yes. And so it's about right. friendship, rekindling yeah. friendship
right.
at 40, how you have relationships that work with women, try to
right.
at 40.
Yeah.
And so, listen, of course I love the movie. You know, we yeah. love the movie. So, yeah, you should watch it.
I will. No, totally, yeah, totally I mean, into it. I'm going to ask
certainly if you like Miles
I've
got to
find... I gotta find My Life's a Turnaround first and rewatch it.
Listen, I wish I have like I don't even know if you have a DVD player anymore, but
I do.
Stacks of these things in the closet, so I'm happy to give you whatever I have.
Sure.
I wish I yeah. should have thought to bring them, but
oh no,
but I'll get them to you.
No, but there's like that. I'd love to have a copy of that.
Yeah,
and you know, most of your other features are very easy to get. Most of them.
Yeah, they are. Yeah, they're all either on Amazon or iTunes.
Right.
You know.
Netflix, whatever.
The only one that's a little hard, which makes me very sad, is Never Again, which is Jill Clayburgh and Jeffrey Tambor.
Right. And since they both have passed, it's... no, I can't. It's a terrible thing to
drink. No, don't say that. And so that, because, you know, Focus bought it. It was actually Focus's first title after becoming... I forget the name of the company that they were before they were Focus, but... they were USA Films.
Oh,
they were
okay.
USA Films, and then they became Focus.
Focus Features.
And I don't think they made it into HD because it costs money. So a lot of titles that these companies make don't right. HDify them.
Right.
And if they're not HD, no platform will air them.
Right. Right. At this stage.
If they don't pay the 10 grand or whatever it costs to make them into HD, Netflix, Hulu, iTunes, no one will put it on.
Interesting.
So they
It's kind of a double-edged sword in that regard
right.
because it's good to have this, I guess, the standards that you're not going to get some crap. Like, we used to get such crappy. I remember this is the, you know, I'm not going to keep you much longer. Try to respect your time, whichever.
No, listen, I love talking to you.
I'm
glad. I have to pee really badly, but that's
well, you shouldn't have let that stop you. Wouldn't be the first time. So I was going to say, one time, Mike Lee, who's like, you know, got, like,
oh, we're good.
Mike Lee.
Yeah.
So I remember the first time. I was going to interview him, not for this podcast, but it was for some like I used to write articles for different websites and Tribeca, and I got Mike Lee, and I thought it was before we were both standing in the early. I ran into him in the green room at Walter Reed or wherever uh-huh. it was, and I thought, okay, I'm going to impress him because I watched all his teleplays. You know, I really watched everything.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
I'm going to talk to him about that and really impress him.
Yes, that you know the early.
Yeah. So I mentioned it.
We really like your films, especially the earlier funny ones, which is Stardust Memories.
The
runner from Stardust Memories.
Right. I remember that. And I said, no, I didn't put it in that way. It was a fan all the way through. I said, I've seen all your teleplays. I've recently caught up with all of them. Like, you know, and his face fell. He grimaced. He goes, and he was really angry because of all the rotten versions that ended up on.
Really?
Like, they were on Netflix mm-hmm. streaming, but they were really horrible copies. Like, they've done beautiful restorations in the UK, but so he just it started off like, you know, with that was the way
it
was fine. No, the rest of the conversation we got better, yeah. Even though he's not the easiest, but he's uh-huh. fine, he's fine. And then maybe on the next film I happen to have another opportunity to talk to him, and for some reason I felt this is how bad I can be I felt compelled to remind him. Like, I thought it was going to be funny. Like, I'm going to tell you, like, by the way, you know, the last time I saw you, I wanted to impress you, and I told you how about these, you know,
yeah, you just dug yourself
your
in deeper.
And you're then like, he just, yeah, once down. Again, he just, yeah. thought, he just, you know, got frustrated about.
No, there's so certain, yeah, help. Yeah, listen, we,
I'm just,
you know,
but I'm going to do it again.
I don't want to say we artists, it's not so, so.
Pretentious?
Yes.
No.
So I don't want to say we artists, but people who do this, what I do, you know, you have to be careful because we're just so terrified and self-hating. I'm not saying Mike Lee is. I know, I can speak for myself that, you know, the little, we get our panties in a bunch about the.
Sure.
I try not to, but we can. So even when you try.
Anyway, if I get another opportunity, which I hope I do, because I'd like to get him on the podcast, because I really do love Mike Lee.
Yeah,
but I will bring it up again.
At this point, you have to. It's going to be your. You're just going to kick that fucking dead horse
until
he's going to want
gets
you.
Up. Yeah, for sure. So I want to know, though, I mean, is there stuff that you can talk about or anything that you're working on that?
Yeah, yeah. You know, well, thank you for asking. There's, you know, Boy Meets Girl came out a year and a half ago.
Yes.
So we shot it 3 years ago. So, you know, these things always take like 3 years to make, shoot, come out, promote. And then it feels like the baby is grown up enough that it's time to move to the next one, at least for me.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm sort of itching to make the next thing. And I think that's going to be one of a couple things. I'm going to, you know, I have a title that's been in my head for a couple years, which is 50 is the New Dead, which I just love because turning 50 and now I'm 55, hopefully I, you know, whatever. I look whatever I look. Some people say I look younger.
You
but,
definitely, I was going to say, for those who are listening.
Well, you know, the point is that whatever.
At least 10 years younger.
And also being a
at
white.
At least, if not. Yeah.
Middle-aged, middle-class man in the world today mm-hmm. is a very interesting proposition and comes with a bunch of characteristics that can be mm-hmm. challenging. And so I'm interested in how the world's working now in terms of the diversity of culture, the uh-huh. diversity of power. Power exchange in our country, in our world. And again, just my personal, you know, it's just really interesting. I mean, I went up for a job and I was told I couldn't get it because I'm not a minority or women-owned business. So, you know, listen, obviously it's a big conversation, you know, mm-hmm. and I'm not crying over spilled milk, but I'm just saying my reality is what it is.
Mm-hmm.
And so, discussing again what it is to be 50 and a white man in New York City
in 2017
is something that's interesting to me and mm-hmm. I think would be interesting again to other people, even in the fact that it's not interesting to a lot of people. You know what I mean?
Yeah Well, it's interesting because show I'm supposed to put up today, which I may be quite late doing, was a last minute decision to move this up because one of this filmmaker's earlier films is going to be on POV uh-huh. next week, so I wanted to make sure I promoted that. It's a film that was made a while ago, but they were doing like a special broadcast of it. Anyway, he's always made these socially progressive documentaries, you know, and he comes from that background. But his new project is called The Whiteness Project. It's you can see it online. It's just in the very beginning, but they're doing an incredible amount of interviewing and data collection, and it's all about for those who identify as white in this country.
Yeah.
And it's like a sociological experiment, but it's going to all be online, this project. It's not going to be like a theatrical, but it's called The Whiteness Project, and I mean it's about privilege, but it's also about much more because it's asking white people what it is to be white,
right?
In this so I know there's some of it's up already a little bit.
Yeah, it's interesting. I love making Boy Meets Girl because it was about, listen,
yeah,
I'm interested in telling stories, as I said, sort of if there's a thesis, if there's a mandate,
uh-huh.
a life thesis or life mandate so far, that's been a through line through all of my work, is this thing of being disenfranchised and trying to create unity mm-hmm. among people who feel disenfranchised.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason people ask me, and never again, how do you write a 70-year-old woman, a 65-year-old woman? You're not that person. With Boy Meets Girl, how do you write a transgender 21-year-old? You're not that person.
Mm-hmm.
And the answer is so simple. It's like, because I patently feel that, you know, comparing our insides is what is important and what we identify with, regardless of the shell that we live in,
mm-hmm.
of gender, of race, of sexual orientation, of age, of privilege, of class. You know, if money and privilege bequeathed wisdom and happiness, the Kennedy family would be have a different historical evolution, right?
Yeah.
I mean, they wouldn't be blowing that, you know.
Yeah.
So
it's
we know
full
that
tragedy,
that's not
though. Right family. Yeah.
The formula for happiness.
Right.
So, and concurrently, you know, you can be born. Listen again. So it's fun for me to make movies about people that are so different looking than me, so different circumstantially from me, but that I can still identify with because in some way they feel disenfranchised. So, as much as I'd like to make a movie about a 50-year-old white guy, and I might do that, I might also make a movie about a 75-year-old black man.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, I really want to make movies about people that are very, very different than me as well.
Right. But there's a universal...
Yes.
I
the feelings
connection.
Are something because I also think that's the way to open people's eyes a little bit and go, oh, my God, you feel like I do, yet we look totally different.
Right.
I mean, it's so obvious. But
well, actually, you and I, not in the case, but
so
New York City Jewish.
That's what I think I want to write next.
Okay.
I've also wanted to, for years, I've wanted to make a Wiry Spindel about a female character.
Huh.
So the same format, kind of a woman who's maybe in her 30s, and we sort of flash back and see her whole life that leads to the circumstances that she's in at 30, in a way that's maybe a little more honest and revealing than a lot of female stories that have been out there so far.
Mm-hmm.
And again, someone will say, listen, there's this whole idea now that I think is ridiculous that unless you're the person, you cannot tell that story.
Right. Yeah.
Which just makes no sense to me.
Yeah. No, I understand.
Because isn't that discrimination?
It's crazy. Yeah.
So does that mean that any actor who's actually gay in his life can't play a straight guy?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's the reverse version of it, right? You know, and as much as I really wanted to hire a transgender woman to play the lead in Boy Meets Girl, I was lucky enough that I found a brilliant transgender actress. Had I not, I would not have cast a transgender actress who wasn't as good as
a
cisgender person.
Yeah.
I wouldn't have. And that's why I think it's ridiculous that Jeffries, who's brilliant, like just knocked down brilliant and Transparent.
Yeah, he's amazing. It's just a...
You know, if I'm sure the producers auditioned transgender women for the role as well.
And, I don't know.
You know.
It's not about that, though. It is about his journey. So it had to be. I mean, it's a little different.
That's true, too.
We're in an interesting, sensitive stage. It's not quite where we were when we were going to school back in the 80s, and there was this, you know, the politically correctness. It's not quite there. It's a similar, there's some similarities there, but we're in a very sensitive moment right now where, you know, Sofia Coppola gets a lot of crap because she didn't cast black people as slaves in her story. You know, you read about that in the remake of...
No. But so she's getting the she's getting a hard time.
Well, it's about this, you know, these young girls at this school in it's all girls school in the South during the tail end of the Civil War, and you know, northern soldier who, you know, one of the girls finds wounded and takes back, and then it's what happens over the next few days. And but, you know, she got a lot of criticism because she didn't include any slave characters that should have been there. But
listen,
she had to go on and explain herself. It's just like a level of oversensitivity.
I feel like
it's like an extension of what we're talking about.
Yeah, ridiculous old fogey cliche of, well, we grew up in a different time. But I will say that it goes full circle to what we started off talking by saying how bad I felt that I tried to convince the Korean boy to eat a dirt brownie, you know. Like I feel scared and bad to even say that to you because, oh my God, will that get blown and out of
really? Oh, that occurred to you?
Well, yeah, it occurred to me. Oh my God, is the headline going to be?
Yeah, right.
Racist Eric Schaefer talks about how he abused Asian people.
Yeah.
In 1977, you know, and of course not. But the fact that even occurs to me by telling an anecdotal story about a boy who happened to be Asian and
yes.
And it could have easily been me, and I got abused by all kinds of different people, black, white.
Yeah. You didn't discriminate about who you let beat you up. That's very kind of you.
Exactly.
See
right.
how open you are.
So, yeah, so listen. But I certainly understand. That's not to say I don't understand the sensitivity and the need for perspective to radically change about a lot of things in our world. Of course, that's true. But what's also true is I think there can be a kind of a boomerang effect that isn't good for any of us, which is the kind of, you know, extremist point of view. I think is extremist that
doesn't serve us.
Yeah, that you can't tell a story unless you're the exact person.
Right.
It just make you know. So what is that? And what does that do to all the great writers, filmmakers, authors of the past? Does that mean they had no business that those stories are now rendered kind of ridiculous because Shakespeare wasn't who he was writing about?
Exactly.
And can a woman not write a story about a man? Can she not have any male characters in her book?
No,
I mean, is that ridiculous?
Well, we're grappling with it, but let's keep a sense of humor and also
and just a sense of a common sense.
Yeah, right. And you're right. Exactly. Be sensible about it. Exactly.
But I also understand that. Listen, I learn a lot. I thank God I'm. You know, listen, I learn a lot about quote unquote common sense.
Yeah.
And my girlfriend, who's. Has taught me a lot, you know. A lot of people teach me a lot. You know, making the transgender, the film with a transgender star in it. I mean, again, thinking I'm, whatever you want to call it, liberal, New Yorker, Democrat, you know, I've learned, I still have much to learn about things that I take for granted that can still be hurtful in my speech and my point of view.
Yeah.
So...
Well,
I agree with all that.
You haven't,
I just think there's a line where it also can be destructive to the overall goal of us all getting along.
Sounds like a good thing to have in a movie as well, or a good, you know, theme for a film as well.
Yeah.
Anyway, well, I appreciate it. Man,
listen, I love talking
to
you, and I really appreciate you wanting to talk to me.
Yeah. No, I just also immediately just felt, not so surprisingly, very just familiar, maybe just...
Yeah, well,
because you know, maybe it's also partly the persona that you give off in the films that you make, and but also just you're very easy to talk to.
Well, thanks. So are you. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
I appreciate you not doing what you said you were going to do, which is
right.
to be super nice and friendly, and then
the
thing goes on, and then suddenly it's
And I would be if I ever heard anybody even speaking slightly amiss about you. Now I feel a sense of defense. What's the word? Ownership? Not ownership, but
right. I understand what you're trying to say. Well, I appreciate that.
Yeah. So I would put
say
that.
You didn't seem like such a bad chap to me.
Yeah. No,
that.
I would totally be.
Well,
that's not the guy I know.
Yeah.
So there we go. And I hope you do the same.
Yeah,
for me.
I would listen. I would love to.
Thank you. All right, Eric. We'll do this again sometime. Maybe with a new film when it comes. When you have a new something, we can actually. Also
yeah. And again, you know, like I'm also amazingly someone Twittered me. That loved Boy Meets Girl, who's an incredible.
This is great.
Singer. I mean, are we gonna? Yeah, this is classic New York. Let's like wait.
We
for
are.
The,
but, to
well,
remind
the thing
people.
Is, when you make low budget films, they're like wait for the beeps. I'm like, we would add those beeps anyway.
Yeah, right.
For New York ambiance.
Of course.
So
of
let's
course.
Just get it as part of
people,
the production track.
We're looking over the Hudson River. Let's just it's heading towards the end of the day. Right. We're heading. It's,
yeah. Magic light, and we have two New York City trucks, park trucks who have a lot of clippings from trees in them.
Yep.
I learned a lot about the trees when I was on the chain gang for a week for my community service for being arrested for felony bribery, trying to get out of a red light ticket, which was immortalized in my life's turnaround.
Oh.
And so,
that's
how long that it's these
been.
Trees here are called Australian pines.
Oh.
We don't have any. They have quills in them that you'll see that keep the koala bears from climbing up and eating the buds.
That's always a problem at Riverside Park, by the way.
Yeah, but you never notice
them.
No, I
understand.
But these so, are we off? You took
off
your headset.
No. I just took them off because
anyway.
I was hard to stand up.
So, yeah, so I learned a lot.
I bet.
About them. They're not right here, but they're a little farther down, and they have these little huge quills coming out.
That's not the Australian pine.
No, you would see them. They have these quills that come out of their... The trunks.
Oh, okay. So
they're farther down. They're on the next stretch.
It's amazing.
But look, and then you'll notice. It's the kind of thing you don't really notice unless you've been arrested for felony bribery and have to do your community service in Riverside Park.
Thank you for reminding me. You're going to have to get me the copies now. You really are.
I'll get you as much as I can.
Before we get off, yeah. Thank you. Thanks for doing this. It was great to talk to you.
Thanks for coming.
Now, do one of those, if you wouldn't mind,
yeah.
ID type things where
sure.
you just say,
so
this is Eric Schaefer. Well, the name of the show is Film Wax Radio.
Hi, this is Eric Schaefer, and I'm on Film Wax Radio? Why did you make such a hard thing to say for dyslexics?
I don't know. It's
say that three times fast. I want you to say
I can say it three
say
times.
It.
I can't do it.
I'm
Eric Schaefer.
No, you. Say you. Your name. And I'm the host
This is Adam Chartoff. I'm the host of Film Wax Radio. Film Wax Radio.
Okay, you're
much
better
than me. I've said it a few times.
Yes.
You can say it as many times as you want
to. This is Eric Schaefer. I'm here with Adam on Film Wax Radio. I've been, because one of the things I want to see happen, so I'm putting it in my mind, is to host Saturday Night Live.
Uh-huh.
And I can't say that. I just said it, but I can't say Saturday Night Live. I feel like I don't say it right.
Maybe it's a psychological block. It's a
Saturday
block.
I feel like I mumble.
I know
say
what you mean. Saturday Night Live.
Well, you have to figure it out. Really
but
well.
I do a lot, I don't know.
Because what do they come out?
But
hey,
I'm not
it's great
I don't think I'm
going to
make it on Saturday. I have a lot of dreams.
But see, you have good enunciation.
But I'm going to
come out and say, hey.
I know, no. You should listen to the show. I fumble over my words
so here's what I would say. Let's say. I'm Eric Schaefer. I'm so excited to be here hosting Saturday Night Live. See?
Yeah.
So then
but that sounds.
But you hear some people say SNL.
ADR.
No, they say SNL. And I think maybe those times, those people can't say it either.
Maybe that's what it is.
It's so exciting to be here hosting Saturday Night Live.
Yeah.
That sound all right?
It sounded perfect. Yeah.
I've had dreams where I hosted, but I also had dreams that I went out with Madonna, and that never happened. So.
It's, again, not too late.
No, I don't think it is too late. No, I hold that out as a – I'm writing a film for Broadway Video right now, actually, and Paramount.
Oh, okay.
So that's a cool thing that I'm writing.
You buried the lead.
I don't want to – yeah. So that's – I forgot about that. That's
okay.
Something that hopefully – well,
it's
because
good.
I think of studio projects as being such a crapshoot. So
– right.
Because I can't control it.
I
can't say we're going to start filming tomorrow. Mm-hmm. But that's something that's really exciting.
Also, you probably maybe are not – you shouldn't be talking about the project like that. Maybe they would –
No. Well, I'm not going to say exactly what it's about, but it's about ageism.
Oh, okay.
It's about ageism.
All right.
So it's sort of about
starting
what
to
we
feel
were talking
that,
about.
I'm starting to feel I know what ageism is about. But that's another.
Well, it's about this idea, like 50 is a new dead. That's sort of what's in happening now. It's the idea, not
and,
just the white
also,
thing, but just.
It's kind of disappear, like being invisible. You know, it's like I never had that. Now
well,
sometimes I have to really be careful.
You know, it started for me 12 years ago. Well, I guess it's 9 years ago that Obama got. When was it McCain? Was that the first race or the second one?
That was.
The first one.
The
first one was McCain. Well, the second one was.
What's his name?
What?
Yeah.
Who did he run against the first time? McCain. The second time he ran against, oh my God, who was
the billionaire? You know.
Oh, the Ted Danson. What's
no,
his name?
Yeah.
John Kerry. No,
no,
what,
no, no.
The good
no, no,
Mitt Romney.
Mitt
was that the guy?
Mitt. Yeah. Yes.
Okay. So
that was the.
So 9 years ago, when John
second time
when I remember I was on the exercise bike.
No. Was
the first time
the
was
first
McCain.
One? Yeah. Yeah.
So
sure.
McCain
right.
9 years ago. Right?
Yeah.
8.5 years ago.
Something like that.
I was shocked, and here's when I knew that it was starting radically for ageism in America. I watched CNN, and a graphic popped up, and they kind of didn't really discuss the fallout, but 80% of America,
mm-hmm.
not New York, not blue states, America, red
yeah,
states,
yeah.
80% would rather see a black man than a 70-year-old white man in the White House.
Hmm.
And at that point, and I wrote an article for Huffington Post called Old is the New Black.
But what happened?
But I'm saying, think about that.
Yeah. No, I know.
That's
but
redneck racists in wherever they live going, no, I'd rather have the N-word dude in there
yeah, right.
rather than
I know, but
my
then
grandfather.
What happened?
You know what I mean?
Then they got him, though, and then that's when they changed their mind back to old people.
But isn't that
that's
revealed? I mean,
it.
Doesn't that suddenly?
I guess so, but I don't know. I don't buy into it.
I don't
that
know.
Anymore.
In America, that they wouldn't want to talk about white privilege.
Mm.
They threw away the war hero white 70-year-old guy. That right. Isn't that the poster child for white privilege?
Yeah.
They certainly. Threw that guy
well,
away for a black man. Thank God.
Right.
In my political view in that particular race. Nothing against John McCain, but I'm just saying.
Well.
My choice would have been Barack Obama.
Yeah, for sure.
And
but,
was.
But I have a lot to say.
But just in
John
terms
McCain.
Of what America thought. Mm-hmm. I found that kind of shocking. And so then I thought, wow, okay.
That's when it first went on your
yeah, one radar. On my radar in a mm-hmm. big way that if America, and again, that's not just the blue states.
It's 80% of everyone.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Saying, you know what? regardless of my point of view, and I'm going to go put my white Ku Klux Klan thing on and go to my Klan rally, I'm still going to vote for the
but
black guy.
But they're all going to be young people under those sheets.
Yeah. So anyway, I think now more than ever, and having parents that are getting older, and you know, and what does old mean? You know, 50? Again.
Well, it's a state of mind more than anything. But
well, but I mean, in terms of being hired.
Oh yeah. I don't know. I'm not even sure anymore. I just decided to make my own now. Open, like create my own business.
Well, that's what
I had
well,
to. I mean, I had.
But that's what I'm saying. But and that is actually in a weird way. Mm-hmm. The upside of the downside is that. So the downside is that it's like millennial, and now I've learned Gen Z is even younger than millennial. That's your son is Gen Z.
Uh-huh. Good to know.
And internet and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. The upside is old people can start their own business because of that. Right, so we're lucky.
I hope I'm not old.
That the very people that are sort of outsourcing us have created a way that we can insource ourselves.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Yeah.
But it's just too much work. I thought we were supposed to get some tenure. You know what I mean?
Weren't
you supposed to be given shit after you work for 30 years?
I'm just hoping somebody hires me ultimately anyway, based on all the good work I do with my
own. That's what I'm saying.
Apparently,
that's the way it works.
I don't have much time left to waste.
All right, I have to pee so bad.
Oh, man.
Let's go.
I'm sorry about that. Thanks, everybody, for listening. Again, I implore you to go to Kickstarter, share it, kick in whatever you can. I love you guys very much for just even listening to the show. So if you gave, I mean, honestly, I'll have your children. You know, that's again, go to iTunes and subscribe to the podcast and give us a star rating and a review. If you don't have an iPhone, bless you. But we're also available on Stitcher. And then if you want, we're also on YouTube. But I strip the shows, just so you understand, of all music, so I don't even have to run into any copyright infringement issues. And even if you have the permission, you know, YouTube could just prevent it. So I don't even bother, you know, putting any music in those episodes. But all the talk is there. So if you prefer YouTube, all the episodes go up on YouTube. And as soon as this Kickstarter is done, I'm going to get it up onto Spotify and SoundCloud and whatever other spots I can. I have to subscribe to everything, you know. So that's where some of the money is going. Okay. And in the meantime, you can find us on Facebook, of course, under my name or under Filmwax Radio. You can find us on Instagram, same thing, and under Twitter, same thing. You can engage, follow, like, love, hate, whatever it is you feel compelled to do. But just engage with Filmwax Radio and let me know what you think. If you're a filmmaker, of course, you know, put yourself on my radar. Why not? All right, everybody. I want to thank everybody so far who's given. I'm going to do that now. I know it's going to be a time consumer, so that's why I'm putting it at the very tail end. But it's a tremendous thing. So I'm going to thank everybody so far, even though I've thanked people already up to this point, but I'm afraid to leave anybody off. So I'm just going to go right through this. But your name, if you've given, there'll be one more of these where hopefully I'll get to everybody at the end of the campaign. I'll just thank everybody, whether I reach my goal or not. But I'm going to reach my goal. There. All right. Peter Rinaldi, Theodore Belukis, Adam Kane, Taylor Moore, Kevin Schreck, Laurie Lusthouse, Adam Siegel, Frank Mosley, Lauren Motory, Jeff Marslett, Judith Mizraki, Susie Greenwood, someone named James, Patrick Bryce, Christopher Jason Bell, Adam Pogoff, Carl Kranz, Lynn Sachs, and Lizzie Olesker, Matt Hopkins, Ariel Cavusi, Doug Block, George Manitos, Jason Cortland and Julia Halperin, Joel Fennelman, Charles Pokel, Rebby Ratner, Alan Lefebvre, Herbert Gamble, Ari Gold, Ethan Gold, Sajiwa Ekanayaka, Michelle Negroponte, Marshall Curry, Neil Cohen, Zach Norman, James Hancock, Jamie Block, Alan Berliner, Adam Reed, Michael Galinsky and Suki Hawley, Walter Monty, Scott McCauley, Tessa Muji, Stephen Stewart, Justin Shine, Jeffrey Roland Leiser, James Oxford, Patrick Wang, Alex Malice, Caitlin May Burke, Michael Rosado Bennett, Art Jones, Naomi Schlegoff, Joshua Weinstein, Alan Ferguson, Carrot Schaefer, Rachel Schumann, Benjamin Dickinson, Alexander Rockwell, Kevin Briscoe, Kristen McCracken, Lauren Wolkstein, Brent Barber, Alex Lehman, Corinne Colgan, Lucio Zago, Tyler Meesum, Tony Hale, Larry Fessenden, Amy Nicholson, Brent Barber, Rafi Rivero, Cindy and Harvey Silver, Jeffrey Hoffman, Innie Prakash, Sheila Nevins, Tiffany and Jay Spartok, Dan Schoenbrunn, Lauren Heberton, Eddie Vellante, Dominic Davis, Paul Brill, Keith Miller, Matthew Seitz, Maria Soker, Kent Moran, Yan Tan, Avi Zev Weider, and Alexandra Berger, Lizzie Borden, Maxim Postrovkin, Bodine Bowling, Trish Dalton, Holly Kulka, Megan Griffiths, someone named Bryce, Aaron West, Danny Sun, Jason Chlorfine, Glenn Rauscher, and Andrea Shane, Jonathan Leaf, Ronnie McIntosh, Harrison Bender, the film panel, Note Taker, Josh Crockett and Kristen Slaceman, Kazimir Noskowski, Bob Berger and Patrick Daniels, Richard Heumann, Jen Senko, Melanie Addington, Ann Andrew, Laura Poitras, Theodore Collados, Mary and Phil Spitzer, Kirsten Johnson, Kenneth Ang, Glenn Kenny, Frank Hall Green, Jonathan Kiefer, Jessica Wolfson, Paul Lovelace, Katha Cato, and Don Cato, Holly Hardman, Elizabeth Sperling, Janet Singer, Philip Shane, Zephyr Throwell, Denari Braxton, Lana Wilson, Betty Kaplan, Suzanne Mitchell, Daryl Freemark, Ashley Sabin, and David Redman, Max Resnick, David Rosfeld, Dara Messinger, Shannon Plum, and Derek Cianfrance, Jonathan Goodman Levitt, Josh Sohn, Brandon Colvin, Elaine Golan, Monahan, Tom Powers, and Raphael Niehausen, Vishin Armorer, Mike and Stacy Colonna, Jesse Orrett, Bill Kinder, Richard Mandel, Rebecca Conjet, Michael Tuckman, Matt O'Neill, Trey Edward Schultz, Jeffrey Schwarz, Mika Van Hove, Nicole Chen, Houston King, David Call, Bill Scurry, Clint Bowie, Ira Sachs, Judd Frankel, Hal Hartley, Jacob Rivera, John Vanko, someone named Angela, Tom Lennon, Amy Lowe, Austin Gates, Jen Ponton, Bill Gay Ibiri, Julie Gordon Hurt, Jeremy Workman, Kyle Eaton, Jason Sondi, Zach Pugh Sanford, Rebecca Israel, Mae Armstrong, Sarah Bellingham, Michael Goldberg, Oliver Ike, Madeline Olnick, Liam Bellingham, Alex Johnson, Jeremy Engel. I think this is Alexei, I'm not positive the last name, I'm going to butcher it, because it's in the Russian alphabet. So I'm going to say Alexei, which I think I can make out from my little Russian that I've taken. Also, Karen Levenberg, my friends Akina Lorber, Neil Butte, Katja Blickfeld, Fiona Graham, Amy Breakstone, Gina Miller, Amy Engel, Judy Twersky, Yancey Ford, Keith Kamen. Thank you, everybody, for that. That's that. I think I reached almost all of you. There's still some generic pledges that I haven't quite figured out, but I'm going to try to reach those folks. Thank you, everybody, for listening to episode 447. We'll be back in a couple of days with a brand new episode of the podcast. Until then, take care of yourselves and the ones you love. Broken lines, broken strings, broken threads, broken springs, broken idols.